This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Hundreds of people lined up in Detroit this morning to bid farewell to Aretha Franklin at her public visitation. The singer's outsized legacy has crystallized since her passing earlier this month. Queen of Soul has been called nearly every superlative, including America's truest voice, as immortal as can be, and the greatest American singer of the 20th century. Throughout her career, Aretha Franklin earned 18 Grammy Awards, recorded more than 40 studio albums, and became the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I guess I'll never be free since you got your horse in me. Oh, 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 yeah, yeah. I ain't never loved a man. Aretha Franklin's 1967 title track from the breakthrough album, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You. Today on Back Channel, we look back on her six-decade career. Later, we'll also talk with one of the directors behind Ava DuVernay's TV show Queen Sugar. With me for all of that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey, Frank.
Natalie, tell me what your reaction was when you heard about Aretha.
I felt heavy, which I didn't. I guess I didn't expect that because I've always kind of thought about Aretha Franklin as my mom's and my dad's music. Although she has certainly been in the soundtrack of my life, you know, since I was a little kid. But I realized how much her music has, you know, really been with me at different kind of defining moments of my life. And she's, you know, she's one of probably like Ninth Wonder calls himself the Ninth Wonder. I mean, she's one of the wonders of the world. And, you know, I feel like at this time when we are losing so many of our icons and legends, you know, she's, to see her leave, you know, just really kind of hit me hard because I realized I'm aging, you know, I'm getting older. And there aren't that many of these amazing soul or R&B singers, entertainers, that are, you know, sort of the foundation of our popular culture that are still with us.
Mark, you actually saw Aretha at the Apollo Theater as a kid. What impact did that have on you?
Aretha Franklin's music took up a huge space in my life. My mother was an Aretha Franklin stan, for lack of a better way to put it. So I grew up with Aretha constantly going through the house. And so when Aretha came to the Apollo Theater, a week-long stand, 1971, my parents got tickets. They took me. And for me, I had already listened to her music, so it was great to see some context for it. I remember it so explicitly because her band was King Curtis. And King Curtis was murdered 2 months afterwards, right? So I always connected, you know, seeing him, you know, doing that tour. But, you know, I always remember seeing later the photos of the Apollo Theater during that week, and it just says Aretha is home. And it spoke really to how powerful Aretha Franklin was to Black America. At the same time, my mother bought an album, a Nikki Giovanni album called Truth Is On Its Way. It's Nikki Giovanni and the New York Community Choir. And one of the pieces that she performs is a piece called Poem for Aretha that, you know, my mother had no other context for the Black Arts Movement, but she wanted that poem. And so with Aretha's passing, for me, in many ways, it was the last real link that I had to my mother, who passed away a decade ago. So in some ways, in saying goodbye to Aretha, I have to kind of finally say goodbye to my mother also.
Let's hear some of the music. You saw her in 1971. She really breaks through in 67, though. She'd been recording albums for 5 years. She switches labels, and suddenly she's on Atlantic by 1967, and this is on her breakthrough album.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel
Natural Woman, Aretha Franklin, the song first released as a single in 1967 and then became one of her signature songs, co-written by Carole King and Jerry Goffin. I'm talking about Aretha Franklin's legacy today with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. I mean, that's an interesting story, just the story of that record, and it does a couple things. First of all, it talks about the many genres that Aretha does, and she's at the top of the field, whatever song she's singing.
Right.
Yeah, I'm one of the folks that would make the argument that Aretha is the greatest American vocalist of the 20th century, in part because of her mastery across genres. So she could sing soul music in ways that no one else could, but she could also sing the blues. She was an incredible jazz singer and, more importantly, a jazz pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we know her foundational piece, you know, around gospel music.
Yeah.
But she also could sing straight pop. For a long time, there was a canned version of her singing People that was recorded at the same time that Streisand recorded it because they both were on Columbia, you know. Barbra Streisand becomes Barbra Streisand. Aretha's version stays in the can for 40 years. but there's no, there is a possibility that she could have had a trajectory similar to someone like Barbra Streisand if she had, decided a career going in that direction.
Yeah, but that just wasn't Aretha Franklin. I mean, one of the things that is so amazing to me about her is that she somehow figures out a way to combine like the world and the church and spirituality and secularity, I'll call it, and sexuality all in, in one song. Natural Woman is climactic. I mean, it and there's phrasing and the way that she sings certain words that reminds you of the church. And so, for her to have the same trajectory as Barbra Streisand, I just think that wouldn't be right.
And it's interesting, right? Because when I say that, I think folks hear the singing piece of it, right? And we would think about Aretha as like an incredible singer in comparison to Barbra Streisand. But also at that period of time, Streisand also had options to do movies. She had options to do Broadway.
Gotcha.
Those kinds of opportunities were not extended to Aretha.
Right, to Aretha,
Yeah, but in talk about the variety and the many genres in which she was absolutely the queen, I mean, Chain of Fools, also 1967, also part of that output, incredible year. Let's listen. Aretha Franklin, Chain of Fools, stayed number one on the R&B charts for weeks, two Grammy Awards, 1967 straight-up R&B, right, Natalie?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the stuff.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of my favorite songs, in spite of the fact that it predates my birth. But it is, it's just so full of the blues, and it is also, just a woman unapologetically saying, I will be your fool, which is so interesting to me when you contrast that with the feminism that emerges out of Aretha's music with Respect and Think. So, she is not only able to cross these different genres, but there's all of these different emotions and roles that she plays as a woman, either scorned or in love or, just a freedom fighter. I mean, she embodies all of that.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, Mark. We'll start now and probably take a break in a second. Roles that she played or roles that were imposed on her. I mean, a song like Respect, that's an Otis Redding song, and it's about just demanding respect from a partner. It is a song, it's a silly love song, in Paul McCartney's words. And it is taken very seriously at a moment in time in a much different way, for very good reasons. Did she intend it? And what do we say about her playing the role and us seeing her play the role?
You know, I think initially when Black America hears that song, they don't hear it as a feminist anthem, right? They hear the demand for respect along the lines of racial politics. I think a couple of years later, particularly after Natural Woman, and we start to see the formation of the woman's movement in the country, mm-hmm. it takes on a greater meaning in terms of gender. But this is also someone who by age 16 is a mother of two. Right. She's a young bride. I mean, so the stuff that she's singing, she's living. Mm-hmm. It's not like a 10-year-old Michael Jackson who's projecting into adulthood. Right. You know, Aretha Franklin is already living that adulthood.
Yeah. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, we're talking today about the life and legacy of Aretha Franklin. Later on, we'll talk about Ava DuVernay's hit, The Sugar Queen Sugar, and we'll talk about the rise of women and women directors. All of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Back Channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark is James B. Duke Professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. We are remembering Aretha Franklin, a singer whose six-decade career earned her the name the Queen of Soul. But, you know, for 5 years, we went back to 1967 and played a number of her hits on Atlantic. But for 5 years, she was recording with Columbia Records, putting out albums, nine albums in 5 years. A pretty good recording artist, but let's listen. I put together a medley of Aretha songs on the Columbia label. Let's listen.
Good Lord up above, don't you see that I'm pining? Tears all in my eye, my pride and joy. Oh, but to you, I was merely a toy. Oh, I'm wishing, been yearning for your kiss. Now I've been missing. I may get weary. Women do get weary.
There's a little sample of Aretha Franklin's songs on the Columbia label, where she worked for 5 years, put out nine albums. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, remembering Aretha's legacy. Good music, Mark, Natalie, but not Aretha, huh? Not the Aretha we knew.
Right.
I mean, it's great stuff.
It is. I mean, it's beautiful because she can sing anything.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. I guess it kind of betrays what she does become and what we know her to be.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly there's yeah. It's Aretha Franklin.
But I'm always partial to those Columbia sides because I think they're just such great records, and what she becomes kind of overshadows what is already a genius that's there. Mm-hmm.
But do you think, honestly, if she had continued, I think, it's great music. Those records sold. I mean, there's nothing wrong with those nine. You don't put out nine records on a label if you're not selling anything, and it is great music, but would we be talking about her?
No, I mean, because like Atlantic stuff, now? I mean, aesthetically, it's just it changed the landscape. You know, those early albums don't do that. Mm-hmm. They put her in a fine light in terms of who she is as a vocalist and even as an instrumentalist. But, you know, the stuff at Atlantic just shifts the ground in ways that we hadn't seen before.
What does it do? In terms of popular culture, it seems to me it does more than that. It obviously launches her career and puts her into a different orbit. But it seems to me that it redefined popular culture at the time, which was there was a much, much more of a convergence, rock, pop, R&B, all coming together in a way that, you know, we had not seen in the industry and haven't seen since. But it seems to me that this even transcended that.
You know, in some ways, I think she was being groomed to do that. Coming out of the church and you know, in some ways she is almost singularly responsible, Ray Charles and Sam Cooke notwithstanding, for translating the black gospel tradition into the mainstream at a moment, right, when the American public was looking for a moral center, a musical balance, if you will, to Martin Luther King. You know, Aretha brought that in terms of the gospel style that she brought, you know, to the table. But it was also a gospel style that was secular, right? I mean, it was not, you know, set off and only in the church, right? This was something that was to be shared with a wider public, and she was the voice for that.
It would have been clear in African American communities that that's what was happening. What about because she was huge? I mean, she sold very definitely crossed over quite successfully with white record buyers and music lovers who may not have known that. I think they knew intellectually. Oh, she came out of the gospel tradition, but I don't think they would have heard it that deeply, right?
It was a sound that no one had heard before. Yeah. I mean, it was just great, groundbreaking music. And she had the pipes to carry what was happening musically. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the 1972. 67, obviously, breaking through. By 1972, we hear this version of Young, Gifted, and Black. Aretha Franklin, Young, Gifted, and Black, a song that won her a Grammy in 1972 for Best Female R&B Vocal Performance of the Year. Talking about Aretha's life and legacy with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Of course, that's a song written by Nina Simone and performed by Nina Simone. Natalie, you know, we were talking a few months ago about Lorraine Hansberry, the woman behind the play Raisin in the Sun, and for whom Nina Simone wrote that song. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the message now and what it means for Aretha to be singing that song.
I mean, I was thinking about that that very thing as I was driving here. And I mean, there's at least three. I mean, there's more versions than that. But the ones that I am familiar with is Nina Simone's, Donny Hathaway's, and Aretha's. Yeah. And I think, you know, Aretha, the way she sings it, it's like God is, you know, underscoring the idea, the beauty and the majesty of being young, gifted, and black. The way Nina sings it is a little more straight-laced. Mm-hmm. Donnie has, of course, you know, a lot of the soul and the church that Aretha has. But, I mean, she just cuts loose at the end and basically is almost like a tent revival, you know, to get you to believe that you actually are young, gifted, and black and your soul is intact. So I think it's really fascinating that these different versions, you know, sort of all in the atmosphere, and I think they speak to different parts of the black community. Hey,
you remember a film like Higher Learning, when Omar Epps' character is on the track, you know, about the practice, and Young, Gifted, and Black comes on, and you realize, like, 20 years later, right, for a whole new generation, this song resonates in a very powerful way.
Yeah. We talk about Aretha as an icon and an important influence in the political sphere. She appeared with Dr. King during the civil rights, that aspect and that moment in the civil rights era. Respect is a song that is later taken both as an anthem of the civil rights movement and the feminist movement. But overtly, Mark, there's not a lot of music like that. This is one of them.
I mean, this is really her first public embrace of musically in terms of her politics in that regard, right? And you see it on the album cover. She's wearing a kind of African-style dashiki and all those kind of dynamics. Right? We know there's other stuff going on. She's obviously writing checks, right, to the movement all throughout, you know, her career. We know that she offered to pay the bail of Angela Davis. She wasn't able to, but had made that gesture. Even the leader of the Nation of Islam, you know, released a statement about the police raiding the mosque in Harlem in 1972, and Aretha Franklin coming to the mosque asking if they need assistance, and then having Jesse Jackson come the next day, you know, because, you know, he was on her speed dial, whatever that looked like in 1972. I think she always recognized at some point, you know, she was arguably the most well-known black woman in the world between like 67 and 75. And so I think she recognized the gravitas of that, that she had this power, she had this influence, that it was incumbent upon her, right, to be able to act upon it, you know, the way that she did.
But it was something you would think that evolved with her. In other words, she recognized where she was and didn't walk away from it.
I mean, she was always sitting at the feet of it, right? She knew that. Yeah. I mean, that she grew up with that kind of dynamic. And when she had that kind of visibility and fame, she could actually act upon it.
And God bless her for it, because I remember reading that her father thought she was crazy,
right,
for writing these checks. And she did it anyway. And just thinking about the influence that he had on her life and the fact that she made these conscious, intentional decisions to contribute to the civil rights movement and to contribute to freedom fighting, you know, on her own terms is, I think, really interesting.
And refusing to be boxed in with the Angela Davis piece around Angela Davis being a communist. She's like, I'm not a communist, but I believe black people need to be free.
She bailed her out. She bailed her out. Right. And obviously, at the point that she was arrested for being a communist, essentially. So, yeah. Well, I think that's what my next question was. But she was able to maintain a highly successful pop artist career even beyond that. So to be able to balance those two things, sometimes you fall off the cliff, right? You become an activist and then you lose your career either because of the acrimony that it brings or because you lose focus.
Yeah. But let me be honest, her album sales in the early 70s are not what they were in the late 1960s, but black people loved Aretha Franklin.
Well, and right? I think it was the early 1970s when Elvis came out with In the Ghetto. It was a time when all pop artists were beginning to realize there might be a couple of bucks in social justice. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not that cynical. And certainly she did that before, during, and after. So, well, let's talk about some of the other stuff, too. Talk about crossing genres or venues. I want to move to another song now. This is Spirit in the Dark from her album Live at the Fillmore West, performing alongside Ray Charles. Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles, Spirit in the Dark, from her third live album, recorded at the Fillmore West Concert Hall, San Francisco, 1971. We're talking about Aretha's legacy with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Talk about the significance of that record.
Jerry Wexler says, let's go conquer the hippies. I mean, that's literally what he said to Aretha. And so they do four nights at the Fillmore West, and it's a celebration also of her music, but she's also covering Bread, you know, all these kind of other mainstream, Love the One You're With, you know. And so it's an amazing performance. And like the last night, everybody's in love with Aretha. All these hippies love Aretha. And then she pulls Ray Charles out of the crowd. It's just and the song that they're doing, right, this Spirit in the Dark, I think speaks to what she represented culturally, right? She took this kind of spirit of Black resistance, Black freedom, Black joy, right, and mainstreamed it so much that you got a bunch of long-haired hippies, right, all caught up in the spirit. Yeah.
It's a great record. Well, talk about crossing genres. Let's go back again just for one moment. This is a favorite song of yours, Mark, and I think one that predates all of this stuff. Again, it takes us back to the Columbia days, but talks to the way in which Aretha was able to sing any song about as well or better than anybody.
A memory from your lonesome past.
That is a Hank Williams song with a Willie Nelson harmonica in the background. 1964.
It is on her tribute album, The Dinah Washington. Cold Cold Heart was a hit for Hank Williams Sr. In 1951, unlike his crazy son, Hank Williams Sr. was a genius. Dinah Washington covers it in 1953. Two very, very different versions of the song, and then Aretha offers his third. And I would argue, you know, we talk about what happens in Muscle Shoals in 1967, but I would argue that the Queen of Soul was born in that moment where you're seeing her being able to take on Americana like Hank Williams and to take on the Queen of the Blues in Dinah Washington and finding her own middle ground, right, to be Aretha Franklin singing this great American music.
While I was listening to it, I was thinking that the harmonica in the background was somebody like in church kind of testifying, you know? I mean, that's what the song evoked. Call and response of it. And the you know, she is clearly taking her time. Mm-hmm. Her phrasing is very deliberate and the organ is, you know, it's all there that makes you feel like you are in the sanctuary with her.
Back in 1964, we're going to do another blend now of music and genres here, both the gospel and popular music. And this particular recording from the album, the Amazing Grace album, Precious Lord, Take My Hand, and You've Got a Friend in this medley. Precious Lord, Take My Hand, and You've Got a Friend, 1972, the live Amazing Grace album. Talk about the cultural and musical alchemy in that song.
Precious Lord is Thomas Dorsey, right? The father of gospel music. You've Got a Friend is Carole King post-Tapestry, right? She is the embodiment of the singer-songwriter. And it's Aretha Franklin who, in this moment, elevates Thomas Dorsey to the same level of a Carole King. Most America don't know who Thomas Dorsey is in 1972. Right. They know who Carole King is. At the same time that she's co-signing the genius of Carole King. It's an amazing album. You know, Three Nights in Los Angeles under the direction of James Cleveland. Her band is there. Clara Ward is there. Her father is there. In fact, her father does a quick little sermon.
Has he ever done a quick one?
Right, well, yeah. I listen to this album in sequence at least twice a month. It's the way that I commune with my dead mother. And I've resisted listening to it since Aretha passed because there's a certain kind of finality about it. But I think it's her greatest musical achievement. Drawing on the strings of Black American musical traditions, she's covering Marvin Gaye on that album. She's covering Clara Ward. She does the Caravans, you know, gospel music's first supergroup. She does Mary, Don't You Weep. It becomes a larger kind of extended commentary on the death of Blackness in terms of folks like Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and all those kind of folks. It is an amazing testament, right, to who she is. And I think one of the great moments of American music.
I tell you what, we'll talk about her legacy and the fact that it lives on as we end this segment talking about the life and legacy of Aretha Franklin. And we'll end with Rhapsody, the title track from her latest album, Layla's Wisdom, in which she pays tribute to Aretha Franklin. We'll do that. But before we hear that music, I want to say that we're talking to Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. And just ahead, we're going to talk with one of the directors behind the latest season of Ava DuVernay's show, Queen Sugar. Stay with us.
Circles are better than the ovals. A Black man left the oval. Keep that style, you got soulful. The best of the best gon' feel you. Sky's the limit. See, I told you, you gon' be the difference between McDonald's, Burger King, and Whole Foods. Do your thing and slip through on them. Yeah, they ain't gon' have no clue. You won't need no toll booths. They'll pay attention. It's through the roof. I appreciate the compliments. Ladies, wisdom. Rest in peace. I love you, dear.
Yeah. We good over here.
We good.
I'm good, man. I got.
Yeah, we good over here. Yeah.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. As of last fall, women directed fewer than a quarter of TV episodes. That's according to a report from the Directors Guild of America. And believe it or not, that number is at an all-time high, due in part to Ava DuVernay, the creator of the TV series Queen Sugar, who has exclusively hired women to direct each episode of her three-season series. One of those women is with us today. Rachel Ramist is a professor at the University of Alabama and the director behind episode 311 of Queen Sugar. Rachel, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Rachel.
Good to have you.
Hey,
still with us, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is a professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. So, Rachel, tell us a bit of your story before you landed the directing gig with Queen Sugar. How'd you get your start as a filmmaker?
So, the first to put a camera in my hands was a high school teacher named Fred Isaacs in upstate New York. And we put a little documentary together called Garbage, Gangsters, and Greed. It was following kind of corrupt politicians in upstate New York. That was really my first taste. And then I decided I wanted to go to film school. I attended UCLA Film School, which is a prestigious program. I was one of very few women. I did the undergraduate program there and then was invited to apply for the MFA in directing. And I continued on and was making films and living my best life. And then...
So you're doing both. You were teaching, but you were also making films, right?
Well, at that time, I went to film school making films and then found myself as I was starting to shoot my thesis film. Surprise, I was pregnant with my oldest daughter, Tiana. And that sort of shifted a lot of things for me. At that point, now 21 years ago, folks were not really very supportive. They said, you know, you can't be a filmmaker and a mom. Either you're not going to make good films or you're not going to be a good mom, which was sort of a lot to put on a young 23-year-old idealistic young filmmaker. So my path took me all over the world and all over the country, and I continued my education, did an MA in women's studies and a PhD in feminist studies, and continued working. I shot a lot of stuff, lived the rap life, a lot of concerts, a lot of music videos, a lot of documentaries. but
so you were doing that hip hop and rap artist, apparently not questioning your credentials.
So still working, doing, you know, incredible things, but outside of, you know, network and broadcast television, you know, big feature films. Once I became a mom and became a single mom, it just, the industry has not been a welcoming place for women, and particularly single moms and single moms of color. So my journey was long and winding. It brought me, after many stops along the way, for the last 9 years, I've been a professor at the University of Alabama, Roll Tide. Alabama has been really amazing and supportive, and I've continued making films and also mentoring and teaching students and staying connected to industry. I bring students to Sundance Film Festival every year. I bring students to Los Angeles to teach them how to break into industry. And really, that's part of the ways I reconnected with Ava DuVernay, who's someone I've known for probably 20 years or more.
Well, tell us more about that, your connection with Ava DuVernay.
So Ava and I both came up through the underground hip-hop scene in Los Angeles. So there's articles about it, so I'm not going to kind of blow her up, but there were not a lot of women in at that time. So when you walked into the club and you saw another woman, you kind of look at her like, hey, what's up, sis? Because there were not that many of you. So really, that's how I met her. She was a fantastic publicist, and I connected with her through a film that I helped to shoot and co-edited called Freestyle, The Art of Rhyme, that it aired on VH1 several times. I mean, there used to be Hip Hop Month, then there was Hip Hop Week, then there was Hip Hop Day, and that film would always show. And she was the publicist for that film. And then we reconnected maybe a decade ago. I am part of a crew called the Crunk Feminist Collective. We are scholars, activists, amazing women. We have a blog, we've published books. And I wrote a blog probably 10 years ago looking at the representations of women in hip-hop and women in hip-hop behind the camera. So I wrote about, I made the first documentary about women in hip-hop called Nobody Knows My Name. Mm-hmm. And Ava made My Mic Sounds Nice, a doc for BET. And so I kind of traced all of the work by various women around the world. And she commented, and she was like, thank you for this. This is dope. I think we know each other, sis. And we reconnected that way. And I said, I'm coming to Los Angeles with some students. Would you come and speak to them? She had done This Is the Life, a documentary about that LA hip hop scene where we first connected. Then she did her first feature, I Will Follow. And then she had done Middle of Nowhere. And so it was after Middle of Nowhere, but before Selma, that she spoke to my students and actually inspired my own daughter to be a public relations major at Alabama. And yeah, that's really where we reconnected. And so, then I brought her to campus for our student film festival, Black Warrior, where she then hired several of my students to work on Selma, which was filming in Alabama and Atlanta. And she's actually kept one of my students around for years through all of her projects, Sierra Glaudet. So we've kind of been connected, but through the student tip. So it was completely unexpected when she called me and was like, hey, sis, what's up? Season 3. Would you like to direct it?
Wait, tell me more about that phone call.
All right.
It was actually in February of this year. It was on the anniversary of my ex-husband, my son's father's passing, which is another whole crazy story. But it was not, it's not a bright day for me. It's not a good day for me. So I was not in a great place. And Ava, we really don't chat on the phone. I mean, she'll slide in the DM. She's very social media. She'll message you. She'll text. But she's not someone who I talk to all the time. She's very, very busy. And the phone rings and, you know, it says her name. I'm like, what is going on? She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, nothing. What are you doing? Like, where in the world are you? And she said some really beautiful and supportive and amazing things and said, I'm not, you know, I know a bit of your history, but I don't know the full story and kind of what pulled you out of industry. You're doing amazing things in academia. You are teaching and mentoring and supporting so many other people, but sis, now is your time. Like, you need to, you know, get back. And basically she was like, it's time for you to get back in your light, and I want you to direct an episode. And I sort of froze. I was like, it was completely unexpected. And she's like, sis, are you ready? And I was like, yes, I am. Of course I am. And, you know, when Ava calls, if you answer, you step up, you find it in yourself. You know, it's a lot.
But talk about that, because you've been doing stuff. Obviously, you're connected with film. You're making films. But, I mean, this is a different level, and you're suddenly going to find yourself there with budgets and timelines and all sorts of things.
And cranes and, like, picture cars and extras. And it's unbelievable. I mean, the resources that you have directing episodic television for a network like OWN, you know, they're like, you have a crane day. Which day would you like the crane? And I'm like, how big is the crane? They're like, 40 feet. Is that enough? We can get you one that's 75 feet. I'm
wild.
Like, 40 feet is going to be amazing. Like, so it was incredible, overwhelming, wonderful. And really, I felt like I was home.
And I understand that there is a kind of a boot camp, Ava's boot camp, right? She's bringing in different directors. It's one thing to say, okay, all women are going to be directing this thing, but just doing a series with different directors, that can be, seems to me, a challenging prospect itself.
Most television works that way, where there's a different director on each episode, and you're sort of a guest in the house making a meal with their ingredients in their style, but with, you know, your spices, your flair. So that's sort of the norm for television. But what Ava does, I mean, she is a diamond finder. She is finding women who did beautiful features but had never been able to break into television, or folks, younger filmmakers who have films on the film festival circuit but had never directed television. And so she creates this amazing supportive environment. There's a producing director. For season 3, it was Demaine Davis. And she is just fantastic. So they send you a lookbook. They send you sort of guidelines about this is the world of Queen Sugar. They give you the backstory. They give you the scripts leading up to your episode. They give you really all the tools that you need to come into this house. And also the Directors Guild gives a first-time director's workshop. So I was mentored by a really amazing woman who directs a lot of television. And so Demaine calls you on the phone. I think we talked for about 2 hours before I even made it to the set. And then I was able to come in early and shadow. I got to shadow the two directors before me, Nigella, who has a beautiful film called Jin, and Ayo, who is head of the film program at Spelman. And so I got to see these ladies working on set and see how it all works. And so you have what you need. As long as you know your craft and you have the skills, you can step in to this show and, you know, make a really beautiful episode. It was an incredible opportunity and experience.
Well, Ava DuVernay has talked about this, her intention to hire women to direct this series. There's a great clip here I want to play where she received a little bit of pushback, and here's her response.
All women directors for 3 seasons now. I can only tell you that the immediate reception by Hollywood wasn't applause. I actually got a call from a union member from my union, the Directors Guild, of which I'm a handful of black women, women of color, are members, saying, you might want to be careful. I'm calling you as a friend, as a man, calling you as a friend. And I was like, okay, friend, what do you have to say? Calling you as a friend is to let you know there's been some rumblings. If you're having all women directors, then you're discriminating. You're discriminating against people. It's real. The real call. And I said, you know what? Thank you, friend. Thank you for that call. I would invite you to tell whoever is feeling discriminated against to sue me so that I can inversely sue every studio that has left women out of a crew since the beginning of the motion picture industry 100 years ago. Because we can do this if that's what you want to do, but I don't think you want to do it. So let's just keep moving.
Ava DuVernay talking earlier this year at the Gloria Awards in New York City. She received the Woman of Vision Award. I'm with Back Channel experts Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, along with Rachel Ramis, a professor at the University of Alabama, who directed an episode in the latest series of Ava DuVernay's show, Queen Sugar. What has this meant to you? I mean, apart from doing the show, which I take it is pretty exciting, Rachel,
yes.
Has it meant anything for your career? Has it changed things for you?
Yeah. Yes. It's sort of changed everything in a very short and quick amount of time. The response I've gotten on the episode has been beautiful and overwhelming, and I have signed with a manager at Kaplan Perrone, Josh Goldenberg, who has been fantastic, and I've been in rooms. I was in Los Angeles very recently, and I was in rooms with meetings with top executives who say, we love that you have lived a life and that you have a story to tell. And are you interested in this show or this show or this show? And I'm like, of course I am. I would love to talk about directing this show. And their response is, wonderful. How soon can you get to Los Angeles?
I love this. So, you're a great director and you're a mother. We love that.
Like,
this is 20 years later, right?
It is crazy. 20 years later.
Yeah.
And so Alabama has been incredibly supportive. I have a leave of absence for fall term, and I have an agreement to teach online for the rest of the year. And I am packing my whole house and my children, and we're moving to Los Angeles tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
Congratulations.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you.
Well, Natalie, let's talk to Natalie and Mark here who are in the studio. Natalie, you've watched all three seasons of the show. I mean, talk about this decision. And, I mean, this is what we've been saying, right, for a long time. You put somebody in a position of power to change things, things change.
Things do change. I mean, Rachel, I so relate to, you know, I'm not a single mom, but just you having to put your dream on hold because of life, because life, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm just really interested to hear, you know, how have you wrapped your mind around all of this happening so fast? And you know, what sort of things would you say to the mamas everywhere who have, you know, dreams, who have dreams deferred, you know, who for whatever reason have made sacrifices as mothers or as wives even to not pursue what is in their heart to pursue.
Yeah, when I became a mom, you know, I had no idea. I was 23 years old and both my parents were dying of cancer. So I became a mom as I lost my mom and, in fact, both of my parents all in the same sort of quick moment. And I had no idea what I was in for, but I learned really quickly that being a good mother for me meant making sure that whatever my child and eventually children, because I have two, that what they need, my time, my attention, you know, things, a place to live, food, all of that, that comes first. And I still have been, I've lived an incredible life and I've had amazing opportunities. I traveled the world on semester at sea, which I did so that I could afford my daughter to be a college student in the program. You know, the kinds of things that you bend and shift and stretch to make sure that your life is, it's bigger than yourself and you're accountable to more than yourself. And so, you know, I've been really fortunate to still, through my academic positions and through, you know, getting funding and support, I've still been able to continue to make work and improve my craft and get ready for this moment because, you know, you can't just show up to Queen Sugar and not know how to direct or not know how to work with actors or any of those things.
Right.
But I had to say to myself, because, you know, my big plan was, well, maybe I'll move to LA in January. And someone said to me, well, like, that's an idea. Like, what is between now and January? I'm like, well, you know, my rent and bills and my classes on Tuesday and, you know, my son has started junior high and all these things. And the person said, Rachel, your time is now. Mm-hmm. You have given so much to your children, to your students, to your friends, to partners, to everyone else. When are you going to put yourself and your dreams at the forefront? And then my daughter called and said how proud she was of me, that I was going to do this and finally put myself and my dreams forward. And
Rachel Ramist, professor at the University of Alabama, congratulations.
Thank you.
Directed episode 311 of Queen Sugar, created by Ava DuVernay, Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker teaching now at NC State, Mark Anthony Neal, a professor at Duke University. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.